Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. Welcome once again to Tuesday Talk with Key West Lou. I am your host, Louis Patrone. Great show tonight, my friends. We're going to be all over the place. We're going to be in Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We're going to be in Egypt, Sudan, Pakistan, Spain, Nigeria, Libya, then to Detroit, Florida. How's that? Guantanamo. So stay with me. If you wish to call in and talk and ask me some questions, agree with me, disagree with me, the guest call-in number is on the screen in front of you, 646-478-5731. I repeat, 646-478-5731. I am happy to have you join me. Okay, I want to start with this. I had the privilege, the opportunity, Sunday night to attend what is known in Key West as the Truman Symposium. We have the Harry Truman Little White House because he vacationed here while he was president. He was here for 11 trips for 175 days. This was his runaway place, his runaway to place. And every year they have a symposium now, and different subjects bring in different people who are familiar expert authorities on what they're talking about. This year, this weekend, it was about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the two places where atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, ending World War II at the specific orders of President Truman. Okay, I attended the symposium and I found it quite interesting, and I'm going to be very brief about it because I want you to read something. I was very impressed. The two primary speakers were two people who were there when the bomb exploded, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and who survived. One is in the late 80s and one is in the late 70s right now. They were 6 years old and 13 years old at the time. You have to hear what they had to say, what they were doing at the moment the bomb went off in each city, what it did to them, what it did to their families, how their lives were dramatically altered, their whole lives, and so forth. It's a very compelling thing, very compelling. Might bring tears to your eyes on occasion. This group that was speaking at the symposium, which included the two survivors, are anti-nuclear weapons. They want the total elimination of nuclear weapons in the world. I've got to be honest, I listened for 2 hours. That was the length of the presentation. I didn't agree with them on very many things. I think I disagreed with them on 99% of what they had to say. But that was the conclusion. We have to eliminate nuclear weapons now. It was totally unrealistic from my perspective. But how they got to this point from 1945 is what is thrilling, revealing, eye-opening, and I recommend it to you. I mean, like the woman who survived, she said, if God is a God of love, how could he make this happen? And it took her almost a whole lifetime to come to grips with a God and Christianity and what happened. Things like that on her mind. Very dramatic, very, very dramatic, chilling, okay? Now, where can you find it? I write a blog every day, as most of you know, KeyWestLou.com, KeyWestLou.com. Just go on the Internet, enter KeyWestLou.com, and up comes my site, and go to the May 19th, which is yesterday, my blog for yesterday, May 19th, and it's the story, it's my feelings, what I drew from those 2 hours, quotes from these people, very moving, very interesting, things you did not know, things you want to know. It'll take you all of 5 minutes to read it. Again, KeyWestLou.com, and it's the blog for May 19th. Okay, now we're going to talk about judges. Yep. We're going to talk about Muslim judges, those who follow Islamic law. We're going to talk about judges in the Middle East. You have to remember that Muslims are moving all over the world. There are tons of them in our country today. They're in Italy big time. They are in England very much. They're all over. They're moving everywhere. Your people and mine, and when I say your people and mine, I'm talking about everybody who came here from before the revolution, the from England, from Scotland, from France, from Italy, from Germany, from Poland. Everyone came here, Bosnia now. They all come to this country looking for a better place, a better life. And when they get here, they all want to become Americans. They wish to live as the Americans do. They learn our language. They learn our customs. They do it the American way. That's why they came here. Well, Muslims don't do it that way. When they go to another country, they want to keep their own traditions, which is okay. I still enjoy a plate of macaroni. I'm of Italian extraction. My mother was born in the old country. On the other hand, though, they want everything the way it was over there. They just want a different place to live. They want to live here, but everything must be the way it was in the old country. And this goes to the laws they wish to govern them. In many countries, they have fought successfully to have what is called Sharia law passed so that it can govern them criminally and civilly. They're under a different set of laws than you and I would be if it worked that way in the United States. And by the way, two or three states have adopted certain portions of Sharia law, which I think is wrong. But I want to show you now how Sharia law and judges operate in certain Middle East countries. Let's start with Egypt. 2 weeks ago, it was reported that one Egyptian court, in a trial that took only 2 or 3 days, had before 683 Muslim Brotherhood supporters. They had the head of the Muslim Brotherhood for the last 2 years, a gentleman by the name of Mohammed Badi, before the court, and 682 of his supporters. In a 2 or 3 day trial, they call these mass, M-A-S-S trials, all of them, all 683, were condemned to death by the court. Now, this is interesting. There weren't 683 people in court. There were only 20. The rest of them, the government hadn't caught yet. Whoever the government is today, we're into our third or fourth government in the last 4 years. But they're not there. They're not caught. But if they're ever caught, they get executed immediately. They have been sentenced to death. Now, this is not the way to run a courtroom. You try 683 people in 2 or 3 days. You sentence them all to death, even if they weren't there. Be happy you live in the United States where you get it all and you got due process, okay? Now, it's just not the way to do business, and let's put this in another perspective. Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, the North and the South. At the end of the war, the Union won. Did Lincoln say, okay, we're now going to take Jefferson Davis because he was the president of the Confederacy, and we're going to execute him, and we're going to take Lee, who was the general of the Confederate armies, and we're going to execute him, and we're going to execute all the top military people for the Confederacy. They're ordered to death. He didn't do it that way. He says, no, we are family. We had our fight. Now we must get together. It's taken all these years, and we still haven't, I think, many times. But his idea, his thrust was, we must learn to live together again. The prodigal son has come home. There obviously are no Abraham Lincolns in Egypt, and this is what they do. They took 683 people in a 2 or 3 day trial and sentenced them all to death, and they only had 20 in custody. Now we're going to go to another Egyptian trial, which just concluded this week. It started this week, and it ended this week. And in this trial, there were two courts involved, Egyptian courts. They convicted 170 of the Muslim Brotherhood supporters. These are Mohammed Morsi. He was the president who's also been arrested. He's been under arrest for about 2 years. They convicted 170 of these people. But I'll tell you, they didn't say you're going to die. You don't even have juries in these things, by the way. You just got the judge. They didn't say these fellows are going to die. They got to go to jail, okay? They did do bad things, though, these 170 people, as probably most, if not all, of the 683 did. They did things like they burned a church, they burned a police station, they burned a sports stadium. They killed hundreds of Islamists, okay? I'm talking about, this is the radical right, so to speak, the group that got convicted. The others are just regular Islamists. And they tried to blow up a subway, and they did more bad things. So, yeah, they did bad. But you have to remember, this is a civil war in Egypt. You know, this isn't one country being invaded by another. These are families fighting each other, extremists on the religious side and not extremists on the other side. Several groups involved, warlords involved, and they're nowhere near resolving this. This is a civil war, but this is how they do things in the Middle East and especially in Egypt. Which now brings me to a very sad situation. And you will find it so also because it sort of hits home. It's a personal thing. Sudan in Africa. Remember, Africa, Libya, Nigeria, Sudan, Morocco. These are all Muslim countries. These people follow Muhammad. That's okay. That's their religion. But live it your way. Don't impose it on me. Now, here's what happened there. We had a Sudanese woman. She was 27 years old. Her name was Miriam Yaha. Miriam Yaha. Well, Miriam was raised a Christian. Her mother was Christian. She was raised a Christian. And she married a Christian. Okay? Well, the authorities in Sudan, the Islamic people, the religious people, the really strong religious people, they said, hey, you can't be a Christian. And the reason you can't be a Christian is under Islamic law, and this is Muhammad's law, a child must be of the same religion as the father. Now, Miriam's mother was a Christian, but her father was a Muslim. And even though the mother raised, who knows where the father went, raised the girl and raised her Christian, the law said she had to be a Muslim. So the court gave her a choice. And by the way, while this is all going on, she is 8 months pregnant and has a 20-month-old child besides. The court says to her, look, it's very simple. You must renounce your Christian faith and become a Muslim. If you do not want to, you will be executed. And she said, and many people are doing this in the Middle East, they prefer being crucified like Jesus Christ, because that's what's happening to them. They're being hung on crosses in many instances to die. She refused to renounce her faith, and she's now in jail. Her case is on appeal. Her 20-month-year-old child's with her. They're living in squalor. She's sickly in her 8th month. Her child, 20 months old, is sickly because of the bugs and the conditions. And also, Islamic law will not execute a pregnant woman. They will wait till the baby's born and the mother has concluded breastfeeding. Then they will execute her. So this is what is confronting this woman because her father was Muslim and she was raised Christian. I don't know. That's pretty terrible. The whole world is up in arms. The United Nations, the United States, Great Britain, France, everybody's upset with this. It sounds very inhumane, and it is, but that's the law, and they enforce the law this way, the courts, in these Muslim countries, which now brings me to Pakistan. I'm going through the Muslim world right now to show you how ridiculous their laws are. They are to you and me. Ridiculous. They aren't to these people, though. These people believe in Muhammad. They believe in the Koran. And you can't knock them for it. But not everybody thinks the way they do. Even their own people don't. But this is what happens to them when they disagree. Now we're in Pakistan. And there's this village. And somebody's stealing the electric power in the village. They're grabbing the electric wires and hooking them up to their homes so they get their power for free. Well, this is wrong. This is against the law. You can't steal electricity in Pakistan. You probably can't steal it anywhere in the world. The electric workers are authorized under law, the workers for the company, to go in and find out which houses have been hooked up. And under Islamic law, Everyone in the house is deemed guilty and arrested. Mother, father, brother, sister, children, grandchildren, everybody goes. Well, in this one house as part of the family, they arrested Mohammed Musa, okay? 9 months old. This is a baby, 9 months old. And they charged him with attempted murder because when they went to arrest his family put up a fight against the electrical workers, and they were charged under the law with trying to kill the people who were trying to arrest them. Now, you got this 9-month-old baby boy. They charged him with attempted murder. They fingerprinted him. He was crying. I mean, he went through the whole routine. It's very important under Islamic law not to have a criminal record. A criminal record in this country, in our country, is a conviction. In Pakistan, it is an arrest. They don't care whether you were guilty or not. They're presuming, they are assuming you were guilty, and so this 9-month-old would carry with him the rest of his life a criminal record which would affect his life in many ways. Do you know it took a whole month for a judge to see the ridiculousness of this situation with this child and to throw the claim against him out of court? Not right away. It took him a whole month. Now I'm going to go to Spain. This has nothing to do with Islamic law, with the Muslim people of Muslim religion. This has to do with bankers. We're in a Spanish court. Now, understand, in the United States, we had the mortgage crisis that occurred in 2008. The banks were responsible. We had the biggest recession since 1929 here. And what happened? No bank CEO, no president or high-ranking person in any bank has been arrested, tried, or gone to jail. And we've been told by our own government that the banks were too big to fail. And then when the people were saying, well, send somebody to jail, someone's got to be responsible, we were told by our own Attorney General of the United States, Holder, that the banks are too big to prosecute. This whole situation happened in Iceland also. In Iceland, at the same time, they had the same problem, the mortgage situation in 2008. And the government was going to bail out the banks, just as we did in the United States. And you know what the people did up there? I told you about this before on this show. They threw the government out, put a new government in, threw out their constitution, wrote a new constitution, and they indicted all the major bankers who were responsible for the debacle which occurred in Iceland, and they're all sitting in jail now. We go to Spain today. Now, Spain is in trouble economically. Greece in this euro problem is number one in trouble, Italy's number two, Spain is a close number three. No one's ever charged a judge in Spain with doing wrong, and not a judge, a banker. Well, along comes Elpido Silva, who's a judge, and he doesn't like this 2008 bank global crisis, and there is a banker, a CEO by the name of Miguel Blesa. His bank is Caja Madrid, and Blesa, the CEO of the bank, had some problems. He was involved in irregularities in the purchase of a Florida bank by his bank. It was a bad deal, a phony deal, and his bank lost a ton of money. Also, he made a 27 million euro loan to a Spanish businessman that's now in jail because the deal was a fraudulent deal. 27 million euros, about $35 million American money. So what does Judge Silva do? Because they don't have juries in these countries. The judge decides. He finds him guilty, sends him to jail. Do you know how long the CEO, Blesa, was in jail? 2 days. 2 days. And he was out of jail. And within a matter of weeks, the charges against him were dismissed as inappropriate. And now the judge was arrested. You got it. The Spanish government arrested Judge Silva and said that he was guilty of misconduct during the trial, and he crucified this poor banker. So now he goes to jail, the judge, and he's on trial right now, and he's fighting for his reputation, his life, his freedom, and to get his job back, okay? That's Spanish justice, okay? My point, bank CEOs are protected all over the world. It's wrong because bankers are whores and thieves. Don't kid yourself. Most of us know it. We should all know it. They don't care. We bailed them out. We saved their asses. And did they come around and loan any money to Main Street? No. Wall Street took care of itself, forgot about the little guy, forgot about Main Street, forgot about the middle class that is swiftly disappearing. This is wrong. But here's a judge in Spain who tried to do the right thing and is being made to pay for it. Now, let's go to Nigeria. I'm back into a Muslim nation. We all heard in the last 2 weeks about these 300 girls in Nigeria who were taken from a boarding school by a group of radical Islamists known as Boko Haram. Now, you have to understand, you know what Boko Haram means? It means Western education is sinful. Western education is sinful. In some kind of Nigerian or Islamic language of some kind, it's called Boko Haram. And this group of radical Islamists went and took 300 girls out of a boarding school and intended them to sell them into slavery for $12 apiece, the leader was going to get. And he was going to sell them to his own militia, his own men. And then they could use them any way they saw fit. Sex slavery. Isn't this wonderful? The girls are still gone. And sad thing number one, it took 2 weeks for the world to know about this. It was 2 weeks after these 300 girls were abducted that we finally heard about it in the media in the United States. And to this day, which is another 3 weeks on top of that, so it's 5 weeks since they were abducted, no one knows where they are. Now, what no one knew until this week, and most of you do not know because it wasn't blown up like the 300 girls were, 2 months before the 300 girls were abducted, 59 little boys, 5 to 11 years old, in a boarding school in Nigeria, were abducted by the same group, Boko Haram. Western education is sinful. But they're not alive. None of the 59 are alive. What they did was they shot some of them, and the rest of them, including the bodies of those they shot, they put them in a building, closed off the building, lit the building up, put the building on fire, and burned these boys to death. The reports say that all that was left at the end of the fire when it was put out were ashes. All right? Now, I just want to raise a couple of questions. Why didn't we know about this 2 months ago, the 59 boys? Why didn't we get excited about it like we're excited over the 300 girls? And why aren't these things always brought to our attention immediately by the media? I have a feeling, and I've spoken to this point several times before, that the media in this country tells us what they want us to know. And I think they are influenced by our government many times. I don't like it. It's like Bush 2. No pictures were ever taken of the bodies that were returned home from Iraq, if you recall, because he didn't want the people to get upset like we got upset over Vietnam. Now, we're going to move on. We're going to go to Libya and Egypt for a moment again. Then I'm getting the hell out of the Middle East, so don't worry, folks. It's just a point I want to make right now, and it's this. 4 years ago came the protests, the demonstrations in the street. The people wanted democracy. They wanted Mubarak out. Mubarak had been our friend for 30 years. He also became the friend of Israel because of his relationship with us. We knew what we had in Mubarak, but right away Obama and Hillary Clinton said, oh, we got to be with the people who want democracy, and they turned their backs on their friend of 30 years, Mubarak, our friend. Mubarak's now in jail fighting for his life. He was tried, convicted. Now he's on appeal, but he's still in jail. And look what happened. What happened to democracy in Egypt? There ain't no democracy. We're into the third or fourth government since they overthrew Mubarak. This is the same, and the previous group, today's people who are in power, are the ones that sentenced 683 people to death in one court and 170 others to jail that I talked about earlier in the show tonight. And it just doesn't make sense to me. Our foreign policy is screwed up when we turn our backs on our friends, which now brings me to Libya, because it is in Libya where the 300 girls and the 59 boys have been abducted. Remember Gaddafi? Bad guy. No question, bad guy. He ran that country, though, for 40 years. He ran it with a tight fist. Everybody was happy. There were some people that wanted to be Gaddafi. They weren't happy. But these people lived the old way. He ran the country. He was a dictator. No question about it. But there were no problems. Except Gaddafi didn't like us. And you'll recall, I think he's responsible for the plane that went down with over 200 people on it, mostly Syracuse University students. I'm a Syracuse University graduate, and I know about this. One of my neighbors, four doors from my home, lost a daughter on that plane, a Syracuse University student. And to this day, people feel Gaddafi sent the missile up that blew the plane up. Put that aside. There was a point where he aggravated somebody. I think it was Reagan. And Reagan sent a missile into his tent where he was living. Right through the opening in the tent went the missile. They thought Gaddafi was there. They were trying to assassinate him. Gaddafi wasn't there, but one of his daughters was, and she was killed. But Gaddafi learned from that, not to screw around with the United States anymore because they were too powerful for him. He became concerned, afraid for his own welfare, and he backed off, and he was basically a cooperative individual with the United States since. In fact, there are reports that he was always cooperating with the CIA. What did we do? When we were against Gaddafi, and when Gaddafi was about to go and they were going to kill him, we were all for it. Down with Gaddafi. But yet he had turned into a friend. Enemies do turn into friends. Look at Germany, look at Japan. It happens. And all I'm saying is, our foreign policy sucks. We turn our backs on those that eventually cooperate with us. Not everyone thinks like us. All we want is cooperation so we can take care of ourselves and they can enjoy their lives. Moving on, I want to go to General Motors now. We all heard, 10 years, they knew about a defect in an ignition switch. For 10 years, they knew. 13 people were killed. Many more have injuries, very serious injuries. They finally got caught after 10 years and admitted, my God, we knew about this for 10 years. We didn't have a recall. You know how many cars they sold with that defect? 2.6 million cars. 2.6 million cars in 10 years with that defect. Now the government says you got to pay for this. We're not talking about money to the families of the dead people, money to the injured people. General Motors is covered. Their insurance company is going to pay that tab. They've already paid the premium. But the government says, we've got to punish you. So this week it was announced that General Motors was fined $35 million, a civil fine, in settlement of their wrongdoing in hiding this defective switch for 10 years and failing to have a recall in 10 years. And what bothers me is this. They sold 2.6 million cars with that defect. Do you know the money they made? It was a hell of a lot more than $35 million. However, that's all the law permits them to be fined. There is now a move by the Department of Transportation to raise that limit to $300 million. Good luck. It'll never get through Congress, in my opinion. You know how they are. They're going to take care of the lobbyists. They're going to take care of General Motors. They don't care about the people. And that's about it for this week. The show is archived immediately, so it can be heard all week. It can be heard for the next year or two in the archive portion. I also would like to remind you again, as I do every week, of the book I wrote, The World Upside Down, which was published in December, a series of essays about world events. If you enjoy the show, you will enjoy the book. Buy it. If you don't enjoy the show, don't even consider buying it. I thank you for joining me. I look forward to being with you again next week. Good night.